Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And due to schedules again, we won't be able to have Paul join us today, hoping that maybe tomorrow and the rest of the week, other than Friday. But nevertheless, I'm just going to go ahead and kind of move forward on the content. Now, this is really, really important that we finish this and that we go through this as thoroughly as we possibly can. And when I say thoroughly, we want to cover every line of this. We're on page 6 of 14, and we left off with paragraph 39 of Madison's notes on nullification. He did this in 1834, as I said before, when what he and Jefferson did in 1798 as interposition became misconstrued and misconstructed into some perverted form of nullification. And so Madison basically has to kind of school people on the correct process of nullifying when it comes to a body union. Now, this is why he's been so emphatic in, you know, going through all of this. So we're going to pick up at starting off with the beginning of 39, because that's where we kind of left off. And so before I do, just wanted to, you know, let you know that I've got a few interviews coming forward, and it'll probably take a while because I need to get through this content first. We'll probably play these interviews closer to the holiday period, just due to the fact that I, you know, would probably enjoy just, you know, cruising through with some interviews with you. So we're going to have a gentleman, and his name's Mike McKibbins, and he is, you know what, he's all things to know and, you know, dives in for empirical data and facts on conspiracy theorists and so forth. And when I say the subject, he's a subject matter expert because, I mean, well, he has a file. And what I need to do is I need to give you the URL, put the link up on my page, so that you can download this database. Or actually, it's almost 200 gigs of data. And when I say data, this isn't 200 gigs of a movie. We're talking 200 gigs of raw data, you know, flat files, that type of stuff. And so he actually, I believe, so one of the things, we're not going to do it up front. We want to talk about literally what he's been doing, where he came from, you know, that the background. We want to kind of get to know each other on the background because, you know, it's not that I don't care. And as a matter of fact, there's lots of people that come to me with the conspiracy theories and what about this or what about that? You know, what about these assertions on the 14th Amendment? And so it's not that I don't care about those things, but I do know people's minds wander. Mine sure did back in the 90s. And so I went through that phase of, you know, realizing that everything I was told was a lie. And I realized that after I had done that, it consumed me to a point where that's all I was really focused on. And towards the end of the 90s, early 2000s, I kind of regrouped and I started really searching for solutions because I realized we were losing time. The more we exposed and the more facts that could come out didn't mean anything if we didn't have a process forward. Hope that makes sense. Because if we don't have processes to actually undo all of this stuff and take this country back, then what's the point? I mean, I think those people over there, you know, that are going to Circus Maximus and entertainment all the time, that, you know, constantly overload, information overload, whatever. You know the old saying, ignorance is bliss. And I'll tell you, the first time that I had been touched by the conspiracy theory and that was in the 80s, I go, oh my gosh, I had a hard time sleeping. And then when I think I had all of it understood, you know, more unraveled and more unraveled. And I go, oh my gosh. And then I could see what was going on with, you know, from George H.W. Bush to Clinton and so forth. And it was just consuming, folks. It is consuming. So let me give you my personal formal position. I think if somebody wants to know the facts, then that's great. You can go and you can find a lot of really good documents that, as far as I'm concerned, lay out the facts. But at the end of the day, regardless of whether you know the facts or not, there is a certain process that we have to do to take this country back, because we have been so manipulated down this path. And this is a huge part of the conspiracy. I mean, do we really want to know, you know, how the education system turned on us in the 1800s? Do we really want to know all of these things? In a way, it's almost like a very sophisticated orchestration. When you look at all the pieces in the orchestra and how they had to interplay, you know, independently even, where they didn't even realize, you know, the coherency between what they were doing and the connections, as well as others, you know, down the line or what have you. So anyway, I think you're going to find this interview great. We're hoping to have, I've mentioned him before, Jeffrey Prather, and I hope to have others. As a matter of fact, all of my latest interviews have all come from, except for Angeline Marie, all of them except for her has really come from this new producer that we have that is out, you know, saying, I think this person would be really good to, you know, so you guys create some synergy and so forth. And it's great. Folks, if you want to volunteer, there's ways you can volunteer. It may take a little while, but you'll figure out, oh, yeah, I can do that. And so if you want to just do something regarding the show, but where we really need people is we need people writing petitions. We really need people in getting local areas organized and those types of things. So, again, feel free to email info@reclaimingtherepublic.org, and we will help you get engaged. Now, as I said, we're going to take off from paragraph 39. And this, let me just dive into it. This is what he says. More than this, the remark is obvious that those who resolve the nullifying claim into the natural right to resist intolerable oppression are precluded from inferring that to be the right meant by the resolution, since that it is little denied as the paramountship of the authority creating a constitution over an authority derived from it. In other words, the federal government, the authority creating it, the authority derived from it, the federal government. And the federal government only having very specific powers within it, was clearly enumerated, basically laying out those very few powers. So clearly, there is ample evidence, as I kind of pointed this out, that a single state nullification is disastrous. This is some of the evidence that a convention, this is all me here. Clearly, there is ample evidence that a single state nullification is disastrous. But I want to create clarity here, folks. There is, in some cases, some evidence that a convention could be disastrous as well. And especially today, with the culprits that are driving a convention, it would be disastrous. I mean, you know, if you're being open-minded, you could say, you know, if the circumstances were right, everybody really understand what was going on, and we reasonable minds equally formed seldom disagree. We all kind of weren't disagreeing. But right now, folks, we actually have seven paths. I've covered this before, but there are seven paths in dealing with, you know, I'll just say the federal government overreach or violations of the Constitution. Seven different paths, and there are different groups basically chanting and, you know, laying out the old, you know, follow us, you know, this is the way. And I'm telling you, the only way, going through this, it is very clear, interposition. That is the only way we're going to get this ship turned around. But when we really talk about this Constitutional Convention being a disaster, nullification. So let me just say, again, like I said, there are possibilities when the planets are aligned that a convention would not be a disaster, right? Not at this time. We don't have the planets aligned. There's way too many people that don't even understand. I mean, there's people that are offering amendments that are absolutely, I'll just say, they're so ill-informed, they don't realize how the amendments that they're offering would actually make our situation worse. Like a balanced budget amendment. It's asinine. That is imbecilic to say we have to have a balanced budget amendment. Because then all of a sudden it shifts to a new standard of how they can spend money instead of the Constitution saying they can't spend money on these things. It basically opens the door for them to be able to spend money on stuff that they have no constitutional authority to because this amendment allows it. See, folks, we don't want. I mean, these people that are telling you term limits, all these things are really good. Every single one of them opens a door that is equally dark and even more pernicious than, you know, than the problem itself. So what I'm trying to say here, when I'm laying down this analysis, is what he's basically, what Madison said here in 39, is that there is never a case that a single state nullification could provide any relief. Never. It never solves the problem. So why would anybody who claims to understand the Constitution actually be advocating for this? This is a head scratcher, folks. Other than the fact that this organizations that are calling upon single state nullification, oh, well, you don't have to follow those laws. You just nullify those. Those people are really trying to contribute and manipulate a situation that make things worse. Because once we start plummeting forward in chaos, like we've lost our balance and we're just getting basically strewn throughout or all across the roadway, that's when things get really bad. And so there's never a case where single state nullification will merit, you know, or actually prove to be a good thing. Never. But you can't say that about a constitutional convention. You just need to get the circumstances right. But there's never a circumstance that makes single state nullification right or good. So paragraph 40. The true question, therefore, is whether there be a constitutional right in a single state to nullify a law of the United States. We have seen the absurdity of such a claim in its simple, naked, and suicidal form. Let us turn to it as modified by South Carolina into a right in every state to resist within itself the execution of a federal law deemed to be unconstitutional. As a matter of fact, you could even add to this, proven to be unconstitutional, because it really doesn't matter if it's deemed or proven. It doesn't matter. And to demand a convention of states to decide the question of constitutionality. So what he's saying here, because remember, South Carolina said that, hey, we don't care, you know, until you get 3/4 of the states in a convention to prove us wrong or to tell us that we have to abide by this new law. In other words, it's the same thing as actually amending the Constitution. Madison goes on and says, the annulment of the law to continue in the meantime and to be permanent unless 3/4 of the states concur in overruling the annulment. Thus, temporary nullification of the law results would be the same with those proceeding from an unqualified nullification, and the results of a convention might be that 7 out of the 24 states might make the temporary results permanent. It follows that any state which could obtain the concurrence of 6 others might abrogate, now he's talking about 7 out of 24 back in those days, might abrogate any law of the United States, whatever constructively, and give the Constitution any shape they please, in opposition to the construction and will of other 17, each of the 17 having an equal right and authority with each other of the 7. This is emphasizing this right here. Every feature in the Constitution might thus be successfully changed, and after a scene of unexampled confusion and distraction, what had been unanimously agreed to as a whole would not as a whole be agreed by a single party. The amount of this modified right of nullification is that a single state may arrest the operation of a law of the United States and institute a process which is to terminate the ascendancy of a minority over the large majority in a republican system, the characteristic rule of which is that the major will is the prevailing ruling way. In other words, when we have 3/4, that's the major ruling will, becomes the prevailing way. That's how our system was set up. But he's talking about actually being able to subvert it and subverting it with a minority. And this newfangled theory is attempted, this is Madison again, this newfangled theory is attempted to be fathered on Mr. Jefferson, the apostle of republicanism. Notice he doesn't say democracy, like the Democratic Republican. He says republicanism. And whose own words declare that acquiescence, quote, acquiescence in the decision of the majority is the vital principle of it. See his inaugural address. He's actually pointing to people to go see his inaugural address. Read that. Well, might Virginia declare, as her legislature did by a resolution of 183, that her resolutions of 1798 and 1799 gave no support to nullifying doctrine of South Carolina, and well may the friends of Mr. Jefferson disclaim any sanction to it or to any constitutional right of nullification from his opinions, his memory is fortunately rescued from such imputations by the document procured from his files and so triumphantly appealed by the nullifying partisans of every description. In this document, the remedial right of nullification is expressly called a natural right and consequently not a right derived from the Constitution. Hear what he said? This right of a single state nullification is a natural right, not a right derived by the Constitution, but from abuses or usurpations, releasing the parties to it from their obligation. No example in the inconsistency of party zeal can be greater than is seen in the value allowed to Mr. Jefferson's authority by the nullifying part. Whilst they disagree his repeated assertion of the federal authority, even under the Articles of Confederation, to stop the commerce of the refractory state, whilst they abhor his opinions and propositions on the subject of slavery, and overlook his declaration that in a republic, it is a vital principle that the minority must yield to the majority. They seize on an expression of Mr. Jefferson that nullification is the rightful remedy to the shibboleth, and I have no idea, S-H-I-B-O-L-E-T-H, shibboleth. And I think that has something to do with the sacred party or something like that, of the sacredness of their party, and almost a sanctification of their cause. But in addition to your inconsistencies with zeal, is guilty of this, and I go because it's YR, you think year, in addition to year or your, and it's in your this case, I believe, your inconsistency with the zeal. Folks, I'm just going to stop real quick. We're halfway through 43. Madison uses these abbreviations because he's kind of writing this shorthand because he wants to get this out. And in those days, shorthand was commonly used between, you know, it's not formal writing, but when you're writing to somebody else and you wanted to kind of make it quick. So you weren't struggling over having to spell everything out and saving paper and so forth. Then you could see this is 14 pages. So, you know, saving some paper was probably very prudent on his part. So anyway, but in addition to your inconsistency with their zeal is guilty of the centrifuge of dropping a part of the language, Mr. Jefferson, which shows his meaning, to be entirely at variance or at odds with the nullifying construction. His words in the document appeal to the infallible test of his opinions are, thus the right of nullification meant by Mr. Jefferson is the natural right which all admit to be a remedy against insupportable oppression. And again, he's basically pointing out that Jefferson said, yeah, it's a natural right to basically free yourself from this oppression. Now, this is where he, you know, really belts it out here. It cannot be supposed for a moment that Mr. Jefferson would not revolt at the doctrine of South Carolina, that a single state could constitutionally resist a law of the Union whilst remaining in it. That right there, that one line is huge because that basically calls out anybody that says, hey, Thomas Jefferson is supporting this advocacy that we stay in the Union and go ahead and single state nullification. Madison is very clear. He is basically protecting the character and reputation of Mr. Jefferson, his close friend, and that with the accession of a small minority of the others overrule the will of the great majority of the whole and constitutionally annul the law everywhere? 45. If the right of nullification meant by him had not been thus guarded against a perversion of it, let him be his own interpreter in his letter to Mr. Giles on December 1826. This is right before he passed away, in which he makes the rightful remedy of a state in an extreme case. And this had to have been 1825, I believe. Anyway, a rightful remedy of a state in an extreme case to be a separation from the Union, not a resistance to its authority while remaining in it. I'm going to read this again because this is what he says in this letter he wrote to Mr. Giles. It was probably one of his last letters. And I say December 1825, because I'm pretty sure Thomas Jefferson died July 4th, 1826, on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The authority of Mr. Jefferson, therefore, belongs not to, but is direct. Well, actually, I think I was going to reread this, so let me do it. In which he makes the rightful remedy of a state in an extreme case to be separation from the Union, not a resistance to its authority while remaining in it. The authority of Mr. Jefferson, therefore, belongs not to, but is directly opposing the nullifying party who have so unwarrantably availed themselves of it. It is said that in several instances, the authority and laws of the U.S. have been successfully nullified by particular states. This may have occurred possibly in urgent cases and in confidence that it would not be at variance with the construction of the federal government, or in cases where operating within the nullifying state alone, it might be connived at as a lesser evil than to resort to force, or in case of falling within the federal jurisdiction, or finally, in cases, well, we're halfway through 46, and so we're going to take this short break, but when we come back, I'm going to get back into paragraph 46. Again, we're on page 7, and we're getting through this at a good clip. And see, this is where I miss Paul, because he would have a lot of different questions. And so I'm hoping that Paul can come back in and say, hey, I'd like to review some of this stuff with you. Anyway, we'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me kind of back up a little bit and kind of reread a part of 46 here, because this is where he's kind of going, he's going through and defending Jefferson with as much zeal as he does himself. And basically, this is where we'll start off with, this may have occurred possibly in urgent cases and in confidence. We talk about leaving the Union and in nullification and in confidence that it would not be a variance or at odds with the construction of the federal government, or in cases where operating within the nullifying state alone, it might be connived at or as a lesser evil than a resort to force, or in cases not falling within the federal jurisdiction, or finally, in cases deemed by the states subversive of their essential rights and justified, therefore, by the natural right of law, self-preservation. Be all this as it may, examples of nullification, though, passing off without any immediate disturbance of the public order are to be deplored as weakening the compact on government and as undermining the Union. One thing seems to be certain, that the states which have exposed themselves to the charge of nullification have, with the exception of South Carolina, disclaimed it as a constitutional right. In other words, only South Carolina is claiming it's a constitutional right. That was John C. Calhoun. And you know what's interesting, and I'll say this, when Dr. John R. Vial, so it's interesting, Dr. John R. Vial looked at me as a nullifier when he read my first book. And the John Birch Society, because I used the word convention, they looked at me as a Article 5 convention supporter, that I wanted to call a con. But Vial, he was pretty astute. I mean, the guy's brilliant. He's got a brilliant mind. He's written, 40-some-odd books on the Constitution, historical academic books. And so when I pinned him down in my interview, and if you can find it, every once in a while I rebroadcast it, because it's so interesting how, you know, this guy just understands the Constitution. I am paled in his presence by his knowledge. And so as we were talking and going through this, I think like a three-part interview, three or four days, 1 hour each day, and as we were going through this long, you know, and it wasn't, you know, all, you know, one day a week or the same week, or it was really strewn out about almost a year. And so I asked him the last time before he came, the very last time we had him on an interview, I asked him to, you know, I really want to get a definitive from you on, you know, where you stand on this. And he finally said, hey, if I had to make a choice, I would rather be a convention of states than republic review. And he understood that the convention of states would not fix anything. and that it would be able to maintain the, because there's nowhere in there where they're going to touch this gravy train of money coming out to the colleges and the education system. And so I go, wow, okay. So I wasn't expecting that, but I didn't expect him to actually say something favorable, because I realize that Republic Review stops all unconstitutional funding. And this, I know this man would have known this and he would have saw this, but I really didn't think that he would just get on board with, but I guess, you know, the fact of the matter is he recognizes, he actually wrote, and again, like I said, he cited me in this particular book, this unconventional views of a constitutional convention. And he kind of cited me because he thought I was a John C. Calhoun type of guy. And anyway, long story short, I'm here to tell you that even though the Constitutional Convention can, you know, as I started off, it can be a solution when you have everything that, you know, you've got people that understand what they're doing and you really have identified a real problem, something that needs to be done. And nobody's talking about what really needs to be done that is in that convention group. Everybody that is supporting it, I don't care if it's Mark Levin or the rest of them, they do not understand. That simple. Because I would never have written a book, you know, like, you know, the Liberty Amendments, or trying to propose any form of amendment at this point. We have to get the federal government into compliance first. They are so far, and I'll give Mark Levin this. Nobody saw the heavy-handed tactics coming as quickly as they have since he wrote that book, Liberty Amendments. And I'm not sure if he would continue to say, you know, that, oh yeah, these amendments, that they'll solve the problem, because they won't. And there's none of the amendments that they have will actually solve the problem. They'll only make them worse. But anyway, When we get finished with this, I will actually kind of go through the seven paths and what we have to do and why and so forth. Anyway, back to paragraph 47. Now, this is a long kind of course here that we go through that I think you're going to find that Madison takes a very interesting approach as he, you know, starts dissecting the view of the nullifiers. But anyway, dwelt on by the nullifiers, but the final acquiescence of the state in the authority of the federal judiciary transfers the authority to the other scale, and it is believed that the opinions of the two judges have been superseded by those of their brethren, which have since been and at the present time are opposed to them. Attempts have been made to show that the resolutions of Virginia contemplated a forcible resistance to the Alien and Sedition Acts, and as evidence of it, the laws relating to the armory and habeas corpus, or it says armory, but I think they talk about the militia here, and habeas corpus for the protection of members of her legislature have been brought into view. It happens, however, as has been ascertained by the recorded dates, that the first of these laws was enacted prior to the Alien and Sedition laws. As to the last, it appears that it was a general law providing for other emergencies as well as federal arrests, and if applicability, never tested by any occurrence under the Alien and Sedition laws. The law did not necessarily preclude an acquiescence in the supervising discussion of the federal judiciary should that not sustain the habeas corpus, which it might be calculated would be sustained. And all must agree that cases might arise of such violations, the security of privileges of representatives of the people, as would justify the state in a resort to the natural law of self-preservation. The extent of the privileges of the federal and state representatives of the people against criminal charges by the two authorities reciprocally involves delicate questions which it may be better to leave for those who are to decide them on, unnecessarily to discuss them in advance. The moderate views of Virginia on that critical occasion of the alien sedition laws are illustrated by the terms of the 7th resolution. With an eye to the 3rd resolution ought always be expounded by the unanimous erasure, in other words, of the terms, unanimous removal or erasure of the terms null, void, and etc. from the 7th. We already said this, but he basically disclosed the fact that while they were in their proceedings working on these resolutions, somebody asked to enter null, void, and etc., to basically declare the laws null, void, and etc. In other words, the state would then be nullifying. And again, he's pointing out that it was unanimous by the body of the whole that they all agreed to remove those terms. As it stood, and by the condemnation and imprisonment of Callender under the law, Callender was that publisher, I believe a Virginia newspaper publisher, that was held against the law. Without the slightest opposition on the part of the state, so far was the state from countenancing the nullifying doctrine that the occasion was viewed as a proper one for exemplifying its devotion to public order and acquiescence in law, which it deemed unconstitutional. Whilst those laws were not constitutionally repealed, the language of the governor in a letter to a friend will best attest the principles and feelings which dictated the course pursued the occasion. And he basically references a letter from Monroe to James Madison. Paragraph 49. It is sometimes asked in what mode the states could interpose in their collective character as parties to the Constitution against usurped power. It was not necessary for the object and reasoning of the resolutions and report that the mode should be pointed out. And I find that interesting because I think that it should have been really kind of pointed out a little more. I think it would have served us a lot easier today had they kind of gone through this. But when you really think about it, folks, the Alien and Sedition Acts, in their day, they thought that those violations were so bad that they would lead to the complete perversion and utter destruction of the Union. And yet they didn't nullify. What they did was they unseated these people. Madison doesn't actually take credit here. What him and Jefferson did in unseating Adams and most of these Federalists by the Republican Party, that what these guys did was they saved America. This is what we need to do today. We don't have a Madison and Jefferson to run for the presidency. We don't have that. And as a matter of fact, the only way we're going to save this, I'll just say this mess, save ourselves from this mess, is for the states to actually do what they tried to do. It's the only way, folks. Anyway, he goes on and says, it was sufficient to show that the authority to interpose existed and was a resort beyond that of the Supreme Court and the U.S. or the Supreme Court of the U.S. or any authority derived from the Constitution. The authority being plenary, the mode was of its own choice, and it is obvious that if employed by the states as co-parties and the creators of the Constitution, it might either so explain the Constitution or so amend it as to provide a more satisfactory mode within the Constitution itself for guarding it against constructive or violations. In other words, constructive, let's instead of using constructive, artistic and or creative ideas of doing things instead of actually just violating them. Or basically, it's the same thing. Anyway, paragraph 50. It remains, however, for the nullifying expositors to specify the right and mode of interposition, which the resolution meant to assign to the states individually. They cannot. It was not a natural right to resist intolerable oppression, for it was not a right less admitted by all the collective right of the states as parties to the constitutional or the Constitution, the non-denial of which was urged as proof that it could not be meant by the resolution. They cannot say that the right meant by the constitutional right to resist the constitutional authority, for that is the contradiction in terms, as much as a legal right to resist a law. They can find no middle ground between the natural and constitutional right on which a right of nullifying interposition can be placed. Nullifying interposition. And it's curious to observe the awkwardness of the attempt by the most ingenious advocates, Upshur and Brerian, B-E-R-R-I-A-N, Brerian, and moving on to paragraph 50, he goes on and says, they will not rest the claims as modified. I'm sorry, folks, just reading through and trying to look ahead with these, what are the trappings on the abbreviations ahead. Back to 53. They will not rest the claims as modified by South Carolina, for that has a scarce an advocate out of the state and owes the remnant of its popularity thereto the disguise under which it is now kept alive, some of the leaders of the party admitting it's indefensible, it is naked shape. The result of the nullifiers, instead of proving the resolution meant nullification, prove it was altogether without meaning. It appears from this comment that the right asserted and exercised by the legislature to declare an act of Congress unconstitutional has been denied by the defenders of the Alien and Sedition Acts as an interference with the judicial authority, and consequently that the reasonings employed by the legislature were called for by the doctrines of inference drawn from that authority and were not idle display of what one denied by the legislature due to the occasion. In other words, I think what he's talking about here is that they were trying to go back and forth between whether this was, you know, really something that was constitutional that they were doing, because they were trying, the other states were basically trying to point to the judiciary. And so they completely lost the concept of the, not just the inference, but the actual, like he said in the resolution, the report on the resolution, Madison clearly stated that the Constitution and the federal government was formed by the sovereign capacity of these states. In other words, if the states had the power to create that, they also have the power to hold it accountable. They also have the power to basically dissolve it. The states have all the power. It, just like your counties, folks, in your state. Your counties have all the power in your state. You just got to wake up. That's why this article I'm writing, hopefully it'll be done soon, but hopefully it'll be done by the end of the year. It appears still further that the efficacious interposition contemplated by the legislature was a concurring and cooperating interposition of the states, not that of a single state. In other words, this was a cooperation. You need to get a majority so that then you can work together. And it's about really getting the states to actually, you know, become one in holding their child government, this thing called the federal government, fully accountable to and hold them to, and take them to task on getting back into compliance. You can't be just printing money. You don't have the authority to just print money because you want to spend it. And so if you really think, and if you really start looking at what they're doing and what they're talking about here regarding nullification, now you actually have, you know, a really good picture. Now you actually can see how, you know, the states have, you know, in using the power of the union, they can shake that federal government up and basically get rid of any person that is violating. Now, I think that there's some state issues of the state constitution and so forth. You know, when I often think when Hamilton and Madison during the Federalist Papers talked about barriers at the states, I think that there's one thing that the states need to do, and that, so it's included in a part of this this push and pursuant of full compliance to the federal constitution. Now, we're on paragraph 57. It appears that the legislature expressly disclaimed the idea that a declaration of a state that the law of the United States was unconstitutional had the effect of annulling the law, which is not what they did. It appears that the objection to be attained by the invited cooperation with Virginia was expressed in the third and seventh resolutions to maintain within the several states their respective authorities, rights, and liberties, which could not be constitutionally different in different states. Now, what he just said, this which could not be deemed as constitutional or which could not be constitutionally different in different states. You hear me say this all the time, folks. The federal government has to treat each state equally. They have no authority whatsoever, and they are directly violating the Constitution when they give favors to one state over another. They can't do it, nor inconsistent with the sameness and the authority of laws of the United States in all and in each. It appears that the means contemplated by the legislature for attaining the object were measures recognized and designated by the Constitution itself. Lastly, it may be remarked that the concurring measure of the states, without any nullifying interposition, whatever did attain in the contemplated object, a triumph over the obnoxious acts and an apparent abandonment of them forever. It has been said or insinuated the proceedings of Virginia in 1798 and 1799 had not the influence ascribed to them in bringing about that event triumph result. Whether the influence was not such or has been claimed for them is a question that does not affect the meaning and intention of the proceedings. But as a question of fact, the decision may be safely left to those recollection of those who were contemporary with the crisis and the researches of those who were not taking for their guide the reception given to the proceedings by the Republican Party. Now, I just want to emphasize here, he says the Republican Party again. Folks, three times in this document, he refers to the Republican Party. Anyway, everywhere, and the pains taken by it in nullifying republications of them in newspapers and in other forms. What the effect might have been if Virginia had remained patient and silent, and still more if she had sided with South Carolina in favor of the Alien Sedition Acts can be but a matter of conjecture. What would have been thought of her if she had recommended the nullifying project of South Carolina may be estimated by the reception given to it under factitious gloss and in the midst of the peculiar excitement of which advantage has been by the partisans of that anomalous conceit. Now, he gets into some, you know, key points here that are highlighted. It is sufficiently shown from the language of the reports, as has been seen, that the right in the states to interpose declarations and protest against unconstitutional acts had been denied, and that the reasoning in the resolutions was called by that denial into the triumphant tone with which it is affirmed and reiterated that the resolutions must have been directed against what was one denied, unless they were meant to assert the right of a single state to arrest and annul acts of the federal legislature, which is what they weren't doing, makes it proper to adduce that a proof of the fact that the declaratory right was denied, which, if it is not silence, the advocate of the nullification may render every candid ear indignant at the repetition of the untruth. In other words, they can continually go on and on and on. And folks, this is where they have this talent, or I should say, let me be clear. Those, I think the more apropos term is the soothsayers. When people start stretching and trying to misconstrue something, they literally have to create a lie that is acceptable, that, you know, that doesn't get challenged. And so what we're looking at and what Madison was really trying to dispel was this complete perversion. I mean, you know, you get to a point where you tell a lie enough that you actually start believing and you forget that it's a lie. And I think South Carolina had gone down that path. Now, this was in the 30s, so this was, 20-some years before the Civil War. And you can kind of see, and so why was South Carolina becoming so resistant to these federal laws? Because many of these federal laws were unconstitutional. They could have seceded, and they should have seceded. Why did they wait until Lincoln? Because they felt that they could nullify, and they just went forward and did that. And the what do they call them? The terrible tariffs or whatever, the abominable tariffs or something like that. When they refer in history to some of the northern, or I should say the federal acts, bills, and so forth that they were playing in trying to hurt and affect the slave states. America at this point in time, folks, really was becoming more and more divided over the slavery issue. And I mean, it was a hot button item. These people got triggered. And so, and they were being oppressed, and they were doing everything that they could at this point in time in our history, in the 30s. They were doing everything they could to lift this burden and still try to stay in the Union. The smartest thing would have been to actually, because we would have dealt with this undoing of slavery a lot easier had they gotten out of the Union. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.